Hello and welcome to the TalkSpot. I'm Tim Scott, and I've just returned home from the Forensic and Clinical Toxicology Association meeting in Hobart, Australia, where I had the opportunity to host a panel session looking at the topic of amphetamines in the community. On the panel, we had some really interesting scientists with expertise in a range of different areas. Associate Professor Rebecca McKetton from the University of New South Wales, she's leading a program of research into stimulant use epidemiology and interventions, and specifically has done a lot of work with methamphetamine. Dr. Paul Lichnitsky, who's head of the Clinical Psychedelic Lab and senior research fellow at the Department of Psychiatry at Monash University, and he's been heavily involved in establishing clinical psychedelic research in Australia. He's doing a bunch of different things in that space, a lot of work with psilocybin, but also particularly important for this panel is his work with MDMA-assisted therapy. And then we also had Professor Olaf Drummer, who will be known to many of you, former TF president. He's a forensic pharmacologist and toxicologist who's done a lot of different things over the years, but recently been looking at some drugs and drivers work and looking at crash risks of various drugs. All the members of the panel are based in Australia, so the conversation definitely has an Australian perspective, but there's also a lot of things in there that apply more broadly. We recorded the panel discussion to release on the TalkSpot, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. The theme that we're talking about is amphetamines in the community, which is a very broad theme, intentionally, because we have a wide range of expertise here on the panel. And it's interesting, we've heard a lot about NPS, and obviously they are very interesting to talk about, and they are an important thing that we have to deal with because they are causing harms in our community. But the cases that involve NPS are relatively few. And what we've seen from some of the other statistical data that's been presented at this conference is that there is just this baseline level of amphetamine use that runs through our community, particularly here in Australia. And it's causing immense harms in our community. And so it's definitely worth talking about that. Sometimes it can be sort of left in the background because, oh yeah, we know about that. But the amounts of people using amphetamines is pretty staggering. I'm starting to think half of you here are probably on methamphetamine. Don't put your hands up. So we have here, though, on the panel, some different perspectives. We've got Rebecca McKetton with her focus on amphetamine dependence and reducing harms of amphetamine use, including pharmacotherapies. Paul Lichnitsky, who is more on the clinical chemistry side of things, especially with psychedelics, but also MDMA, as you've heard about already today. And Olaf Drummer, we just heard a talk about increased crash risk of various drugs, including amphetamines. And also Olaf's been involved in a lot of post-mortem work, toxic, lethal levels of amphetamines. So a wide range of perspectives, and we're going to cover a bunch of different topics. I've taken note of the questions that have been submitted from you guys throughout today, and I will weave them into the discussion as appropriate. But let's start with talking about what is an amphetamine, because as a chemist, I tend to define things based on their chemistry. And so methamphetamine is very chemically similar to MDMA. It makes sense to me that they fit under this banner of amphetamines. But that's not the only way to look at it. Rebecca, how would you regard MDMA and methamphetamine?
Well, I have to confess, one of the first things I did in my PhD on amphetamine was read a chapter on the molecular structure of amphetamine, methamphetamine, MDMA, and various other analogs to understand why they're similar. But unfortunately, a lot of my colleagues don't do that. I got an email from a senior professor just yesterday asking whether or not cocaine was an amphetamine. And so I guess my point is, in the public health field, it can be often frustrating because people categorize stimulants together. And a stimulant is anything that is an upper or a stimulator. And it's very hard to explain that sometimes alcohol has stimulant properties, but in that public health sense, it comes under the rubric of a depressant. So we do have some challenges in that way. I mean, personally, I put amphetamine and methamphetamine together because they are quite similar in their chemical structure, and they often are used by the same people, and they have very similar harms. And effects when they were taken. And because on the street, when you talk to someone, you can't say to them, are you using amphetamine or methamphetamine? They go, I'm using ice or I'm using speed. So I can't differentiate between them. But ecstasy, we had a bit of a conversation amongst us, and it's like, no, no, to me, ecstasy is different. It's used by often different people. There is an overlap. It's used in a different way. It's taken usually orally or not injected. It's usually taken infrequently. It's a recreational drug, and it's not associated with many harms. So to me, I like to put that in a different box when I'm doing my research. And I think that it's described in some camps as an entactogen. Is that correct? So is that helpful to?
Yeah, definitely. Paul, you can probably elaborate a bit on that, the descriptions of MDMA that come about.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I suppose I'll search for one kind of neat definitional framework is just a flawed search. There's just going to be different ways of thinking about these things. And certainly, you know, in the clinical application, I think about, you know, the clinical utility and the clinical harms and what we can do in a controlled setting. And certainly, you know, as far as I understand, the clinical utility of MDMA is quite different than another amphetamine like methamphetamine. You know, there may be some clinical applications, but it's certainly not so obvious as what we see with MDMA. And also, there's some interesting little studies out there that might give some sense of, you know, the different levels of harm in self-prescribing, self-use. There was a head-to-head with deamphetamine, MDMA, and LSD. And you can see very clearly in these neat little graphs, I think it was Matthias Lichty's lab, that deamphetamine is getting, you know, far stronger levels of sympathomimetic effects, you know, heart rate, blood pressure, and so on, higher than the utilized dose of MDMA. But MDMA is getting far higher psychoactive effects and the kind of psychoactive effects that are useful in therapy. So, you know, people who are self-medicating with these different drugs, if we look at something like LSD, it's you know, incredibly potent drug. It's, you know, potent at the microgram range. So people are going to use far lower doses of MDMA, getting, you know, whatever effect they're after, than with something like an amphetamine. Another amphetamine.
Yeah, look, I agree. Amphetamine is one of those terms that has been bandied around, but I see more as a pharmacological classification. I mean, whether it's cathinone, which is an amphetamine in many ways, but all the different activities. Some are entactogens, some are like methamphetamine. They just happen to have a nitrogen there. The pharmacological classification is so variable. Dopamine activity, serotonin activity, noradrenaline activity, usually combined activities, and then all the other activities, such as prolactin effects, for example. It's a term probably came up, God knows when, in the 1920s, someone coined the term amphetamine. Deamphetamine is used to treat AHEH quite effectively in most cases, yet some parts of Europe it's used as a drug of dependence, or, you know, it's actually an abused drug rather than methamphetamine in Australia. So I think a pharmacological classification is better, like a stimulant, although that's a very generic term too. Some are stimulants, like MDMA is a stimulant, as well as being a entactogen. A lot of drugs will have multiple effects. And the newer drugs we see in MPSs, quite often they'll have other effects that we don't yet quite understand. It might be a novel benzodiazepine, look like a benzodiazepine, they'll have other effects potentially without knowing what they are at this point in time. So I don't think a term, like you said, Paul, it's going to be very helpful. Helps in us talking about the product or a substance, but in terms of covering a wide range of compounds there, they'll have different activities, different effects, and it's hard to lump them into one generic sort of term.
One area where you do see them grouped often is when it comes to talking about their toxic effects, because they do have sort of similar toxic effects when they're in overdose, hypothermia, tachycardia, those kind of things. So often post-mortem work and things like that, they will often be grouped because they're producing similar effects in causing death, at least, or severe toxicity.
So I'll just add on that, Tim, methamphetamine, as distinct from MDMA, doesn't have the same effect on temperature regulation. So people may become aggressive, psychotic, all those sort of symptoms there, but really die from the direct effects of methamphetamine. They may, with time, develop heart disease and other secondary manifestations of long-term drug use, but the acute effects are not as obvious as sometimes people using 4 or 5 pills of ecstasy in a nightclub, where they become hypothermic and that sets up a series of events that lead to their subsequent death. So even though they're both so-called amphetamines, they work quite differently.
So I mentioned the harms that amphetamine's causing in our community, but the term amphetamines in the community isn't just about harms. Perhaps there's a place for amphetamines in the right context. And Paul, you've talked a bit today about the uses and potential future uses of MDMA in that space. Australia seems to be leading the way in a sense in that. Why do you think that is? Australia often seems to lag behind some of these things.
Yeah. I don't think we're leading the way yet. We really are new kids on the block, but we've just entered the space very quickly. And kind of there have been policy changes that have come very soon after our arrival into the research conversation. But no, there's certainly a lot more research happening in the US and Europe in particular in MDMA and other psychedelic trials. Yeah, but, you know, again, in this context here, like the conversation that I typically have is one that takes us from a focus on drugs to a focus on psychotherapy. And that's another difference here. You know, we're often talking about the kind of behavioral contribution to risks. In this case, there's a behavioral contribution to benefit. And, you know, in the case of MDMA-assisted therapy, it's really best thought of as an augmented psychotherapy, and that is its kind of key utility so far. And the same goes for all the other psychedelic treatments. We don't have any good evidence to show, you know, the impressive levels of safety and impressive clinical effects with the drugs, the psychedelic drugs and MDMA delivered on their own. So far in all the trials, it's all delivered alongside quite a substantial amount of psychotherapy. And when you're working with it, you can see why that's the case, why it's needed for safety, why it's needed for reliable efficacy or more reliable efficacy than you'd get with self-medication. I think the conversation around, you know, the benefits and harms associated with these drugs also needs to take in the method of use, not just the dosage and so on.
Is that something you've seen, Rebecca? The method of use makes a big difference in terms of the harm to benefit ratio?
Absolutely. I mean, we have seen with amphetamine, and I'm talking about not the broad class of amphetamines, but amphetamine use as in the molecule amphetamine before methamphetamine became a thing in Australia, that people were snorting it and swallowing it, and there were quite low levels of harm associated with that because it has a slow onset and it has a lower dependence liability because of that. Consequently, we were seeing very low levels of harm, and we were seeing the harm specifically with people who injected. And as I tried to explain earlier today, now with smoking, we've got another method of administration that's potentially related to greater harm. And definitely, once you get into those more potent routes of administration, those more direct routes of administration, you get more frequent use. And that frequency of use develops tolerance. You get tolerance, you get dependence, and it's very hard to slow down, and it escalates.
I think also the strength of methamphetamine, 100% pure almost, compared to 10, 20% many years ago. So the dose increases by whichever route they're taking. Cannabis, it's often see 20% THC purity, whereas you go back to 10, 20 years, 2 or 3 or 4%. So the doses increase, and the meth administration has also made it more efficient to deliver the drug to their body. So that also increases the harm and abuse liability.
And I think in Europe there's now data coming out that the increased potency of cannabis is related to some of the harms, like the risk of psychosis. I was actually going to pick up on a point you made, Paul, if that's okay. You were talking about MDMA and its therapeutic uses, and I felt that you demonized methamphetamine a little bit. Oh. Because it also has therapeutic uses, and it always has. Like, and it's a long history. If you go back to the turn of the 1900s, from the 1800s, it was not uncommon to use cocaine to medicate opioid dependence. Methamphetamine and amphetamine were used as antidepressant drugs before we had tricyclics. So there's a really long history of using these what are now illicit drugs in the therapeutic context.
Please accept my sincere apologies. I didn't mean to at all. I guess it's just, and again, I often want to draw a distinction, not between legal and illegal or between different classes of drugs, but often the method of use is what matters. And absolutely, you're right. I mean, most of the drugs that cause a lot of harm in the community have got clinical utility. I'm just far less familiar with the clinical utility of methamphetamine.
think also those days it was more a prescribed medication, controlled medication. If you were able to control administration, illicit drugs to the community, you wouldn't have the same harm as you get now, where you don't know what dose you're taking, don't know what's in those doses. We see all sorts of drugs in a pill, even drugs different to what you're actually buying, uncontrolled doses, too frequent usage. So but when you control that, such as a psychedelic trial that you're doing, Paul, irrespective of the benefits to the person, you control that dose, you limit the undesired consequences of that drug, whatever that consequence might be, in the short term or long term.
Yeah, one of the things I'm interested in is the gap in abuse liability and harms between MDMA in our trials and psilocybin or LSD. So the classic psychedelics are pretty unusual drugs in that their abuse liability is just unbelievably low. They don't cause drug-seeking behavior. There's no dependence. There's no withdrawal. There's no known overdose. And the habituation is very rapid. If you take LSD 3 days in a row, on your third day, it's barely doing anything for you. So, you know, MDMA has that higher abuse liability. It does produce drug-seeking behavior. There are some issues with it. And yet it's got this amazing clinical potential here. So I'm very interested in some of these either combination treatments or new drugs that are being developed that really are trying to kind of bridge the characteristics of MDMA and the classic psychedelics. I mean, there are these what are called candy flipping trials. There's been one so far where they use LSD combined with MDMA. It's got its own kind of issues, but it's got some interesting therapeutic rationale for it. But there are a number of new molecules that are being chased right now that potentially have, you know, that habituation that you see in LSD and psilocybin, but potentially kind of do what some of MDMA does.
That brings up an important point following on from what Rebecca was saying about the stigma that's associated with amphetamines broadly, and I'd include MDMA in that as well. Paul, have you found that's been a barrier in trying to get these things used clinically?
Yeah, it's funny. I work right at the intersection between stigma and hype. I got both those problems, and it's a funny place to work. So, honestly, in general, with all the key decision makers at my university, at state government, at the Office of Drug Control, when I import these drugs, I've generally felt like I've been treated completely fairly. everybody seems very sensible and following the data and so on. Certainly, though, from our patient's perspective, they can have an isolated kind of experience, one in which they don't feel it's easy for them to share what treatment they're engaged in with their community. And that's, you know, the stigma only exacerbates what is often the isolation that people that undergo psychedelics treatment might feel, because they've often gone through an experience that has been one of the most personally profound and maybe challenging experiences of their lives. It's by definition ineffable. You can't put it into words. And if the people around you haven't tried that, you can feel, or your therapist, you go back to your psychologist and they don't know what you're talking about. That's another level of isolation. So I think the stigmas are still out there, but it's, in the psychedelic space, I think it's far more complex. There's a lot more hype that I notice than stigma at the moment in the clinical space. Yeah.
Is that stigma a barrier in coming up with treatment options for methamphetamine dependence?
I think it's one of the biggest barriers to people seeking help in the first place, even through existing treatments. The treatment coverage for methamphetamine use disorder, dependence, whatever you want to call it, in Australia is, I think it's below 20% for anyone who's used in the past year. There are a range of different barriers. Just trying to find a treatment center that matches your needs and get into it is hard. But one of the big barriers is that people who are using the drug, I mean, it's kind of twofold, actually. They like using the drug. Often they are self-medicating. This is a therapeutic drug. It improves mood. It solves a lot of problems for people, gives them a lot of energy. That, for them, is their medicine, and they don't want to stop using it for that reason. But in addition to that, to come out and tell your friends, if you've got a job, if you've got children, if you've got people around you, if you go to rehab, they're going to notice. If you even going to see a counselor might be okay, but there's a large proportion of people who don't want to kind of come out, if you like. If you think about your drinking behavior, and there might be times in your life where you might have drunk too much or you've done something else, it's actually quite a process to go, actually, I need to do something about this. And that's going to involve telling the people I love, that my friends and family, and that's going to have an impact on how they see me. So, yes, in short, yes.
One of the concerns that people might have, and I'm just talking about the public in general here, is that the legalization and the clinical use of some of these compounds might then lead to increased use, you know, for other purposes, and which leads to further harms and things like that. I mean, we do have an example of this with dexamphetamine, not an example of leading to increased harms, but this drug has been legal for quite some time. It's used for certain conditions. Do we have evidence that that's led to an increase in other amphetamine use? Do you know anything about that, Rebecca?
Best to understand the evidence, people who are medicated with dexamphetamine or other methylphenidate, other stimulants for ADHD, they don't have an elevated risk of developing dependence to methamphetamine use as they grow up. The kids with ADHD, if they're not medicated, do have an elevated risk of developing substance use dependence later on. So the challenge is you've got a disorder which can increase the risk of substance use if you don't medicate it. It's not actually the medication per se that's leading to that problem. I don't know a lot about the diversion and the other misuse, but I do know amongst people who use methamphetamine, we don't see much dexamphetamine use. I mean, that's kind of like they're taking the equivalent of maybe 200-300 milligrams of methamphetamine in a dose compared to what you get in a tablet, which is 5 milligrams. So I don't think it's an issue. I know that there are people concerned about diversion in the broader population.
There may be a related kind of trend that I'm noticing in the psychedelic space. There's certainly an uptick in use of psilocybin, which is widely available in magic mushrooms, and it seems to be, you know, a lot of it is motivated by self-medication. Now, over the last 10 years, we've definitely seen an uptick in that. I don't know about the MDMA data in the last 10 years, but certainly psilocybin. And my guess is there is a fair bit of kind of what you'd call like hashtag because science misuse, you know? And while there's no data that I'm aware of for this, I'm certainly hearing from a lot of the folk in the psychotherapy, psychiatry community of an uptick in kind of what you'd call psychedelic casualties. And the risks. So the risks with psilocybin are mostly not physiological, but are psychological. So people can have incredibly difficult, traumatic psychedelic experiences, and that's okay if it's transient potentially. But the issue is when it lasts, and there are all kinds of manifestations of that. And definitely, there's a noticeable uptick in those presentations in private psychotherapy and psychiatry and so on. People, you know, running aground while trying to self-medicate without support.
One thing that's been happening in this space over the last several years is the National ICE Task Force, which is trying to combat some of the harms that are caused by amphetamines in the community. And I guess some of the broad recommendations, very broad, from that are that there should be increased targeted prevention and treatment. Olaf, I wonder if you can comment on the overall statistics. Is amphetamine use increasing, decreasing in general?
Yeah, look, my impression is, and what I've seen, it is increasing, has increased. Certainly in courts, criminal cases, drugs and drivers, it has increased. You know, a lot of violence associated in our streets are often associated with people using methamphetamine. A lot of good data that goes back many years in terms of the incidents, but my impression it has increased, despite attempts to stop seizures, you know, all that custom control has actually, if anything, increased rather than decreased. And presumably the harms have also gradually increased as these people are longer and longer on methamphetamine, and then often a couple of other drugs as well. I think it's, if anything, is increasing rather than necessarily stabilising or going down.
you know, the prevention is obviously a difficult thing. Increasing the treatment, it's not a nice thing to say, I suppose, but Rebecca, you know better than any of us that it's not so easy to find treatments that actually work for methamphetamine.
Yeah, I think that was one of the things that was very frustrating when they brought about the nationalized task force. I mean, I was one of the people who went up to Parliament House and spoke in front of a panel of people, and I've done that several times. And the question is, well, what should we do? And as a field, we don't have a unified answer. We don't. When they did the drug summit in New South Wales back in the late 1990s, it was proposed that we roll out methadone, that we put naloxone out there to reduce overdoses. We had things that could be recommended, and I don't think that we have a similar recommendation or a set of recommendations to put forward for amphetamine. Because we don't have a good pharmacotherapy, psychological treatments, that's not to say they're not important, but they're so, the way they're implemented is so ad hoc, and it's really difficult to roll that out. So all they could do is inject a bit more money into the system and hope for the best. I shouldn't say it like that, but that's kind of how it felt.
Just a quick little news bite from the psychedelic perspective, although it's very early days. There's a trial that just concluded, a very small pilot study in Sydney, St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney. I'm involved in it, using psilocybin-assisted therapy for methamphetamine use disorder. And look, it's a complicated situation to deal in. And if psilocybin's got a place in the future, then I'm sure it'll just be one part of a much broader kind of interventional approach. But from that small pilot with 10 people, the signs were pretty promising. So. Yeah, there are now, I think, three other studies with psilocybin for methamphetamine use around the world. Very small pilots, but this is the first kind of look-see.
Just add to that, coming back to the stigma, it's interesting, one of the medications also trialed at St. Vincent's is a long-acting dexamphetamine. And don't quote me on this in case I'm wrong, but I'm one of the investigators on that study, and I do recall having a problem getting the company to sponsor the medication for the trial because they treat kids and they don't want their medication associated with people who use methamphetamine. So that's another barrier, if you like, because it's an illegal behavior.
And one of the more complicating issues, which we've heard a lot about already at this conference, is polydrug use. These amphetamines are not just being used on their own. Even when they're used clinically, they may not only be used on their own because sometimes you're treating very complex syndromes and things. So are the treatment options or the potential treatment options going to be different when treating someone who's using multiple drugs, one of which is an amphetamine, compared to meth on its own?
It's a good question, and it's going to be a big challenge. What's happening in the US is they're getting a lot of opioid plus amphetamine, and historically we've had that here in Australia too. And I think that's one of the challenges. Opioid agonist therapy targets opioid use. A lot of these people are still using methamphetamine. It's not being treated. It's not being dealt with. So having a drug that could act across different drug types, a medication that could act across different drug types would be great. I was hoping N-acetylcysteine might be one of those drugs. It turned out not to be. Some of the behavioral therapies work across different drug types, so that's a possibility. But yeah, it would be great if we could have a pharmacotherapy that would reduce craving across drug types, but we don't.
Also, on the street, sort of myths, for example, using methamphetamine can or affects a GHB or other depressants, which is not the case. But, you know, for many cases where there's been that, oh, well, I'll take some methamphetamine, it'll reverse the effects of GHB or too much alcohol or whatever. So actually worse makes it worse. But you know, lack of information by the general public, and that's very hard to get to. Some different drugs involved, and obviously they buy drugs that may not be the drug that they expect to get, which complicates things even further. But the knowledge of the community of that, what the effects of drugs are, is just so limited. What they see on the internet, on their mobile phone, what is the truth is often quite different. It doesn't help in terms of the use of those substances to deal with the situation they've got, whether it's a mood disorder or depression or just having a bit of fun. but don't understand the consequences of that. The same way of using 5 MDMA tablets at a rave party or a disco event, that's far more dangerous than just taking one pill. But that's not often understood by a lot of people, it seems. But how we get that to the general public, make them more aware of they choose to use drugs more wisely, that's a bit of a challenge too. Can't do anything else about the manifestation of drug use in the community.
I mean, there are a lot of young outreach workers running around these dance parties trying to give out that information. Whether that reaches everyone, dance party, it's obviously not working quite well enough. But, yeah, there are people who are making efforts in that area.
And just to add, like, again, a completely different angle on polypharmacy here, we're trying to go in the other direction with respect to MDMA and psilocybin as a therapeutic. So typically in all trials, everybody needs to come off their psychotropic medication before they enter the trial, which has, you know, in some cases, we've got some good reason to do so. In other cases, it's just an abundance of caution, or we're trying to get a, you know, we're trying to homogenize the samples so that we don't contaminate our scientific parameters. But of course, a lot of people struggle to come off their antidepressants or anxiolytics, and it could put people at harm, you know. And so we need to do those trials, and that's something that I'm trying to get up as well, is a trial that would combine antidepressants with MDMA. We do know that antidepressants, and even recent discontinuation of antidepressants, causes dose blunting in MDMA effects, subjective MDMA effects. So there may be the need to do a dose titration study with MDMA to potentially get a find a higher safe dose that is therapeutically useful as well. It may not be safe. We don't know, but there's a huge population of folk who would struggle to come off antidepressants before engaging in something like MDMA or psilocybin, and that's work we need to do as well.
Rebecca, you mentioned in your presentation earlier about the maximal effects of methamphetamine aren't necessarily correlated to the concentrations, and I want to come to that in a moment. But, Paul, just in terms of the MDMA studies that have been done, has there been pharmacokinetic data collected for MDMA while these studies are being done, and how does that correlate with the timing in terms of the effect?
Yeah, no, there has. So there's, you know, this is done a while back, phase one studies with PK and PD showing, I can't recall now, I'll have to dig it up, but what you'd expect, that, you know, subjective effects are tracking pretty neatly with blood levels, with something like MDMA, that's up and down pretty quick. Usually you start to see, you know, the kind of descent phase just a few hours after, if you just have a single therapeutic dose of MDMA at about 100 to 150 milligrams of MDMA, if about 4 hours later it's on its way down again. But I don't know enough of the details to say more than that.
Sure. And so what about methamphetamine? Just take us through again the difference between the effect and the blood concentrations that you might find in those time profiles.
Yeah, so what the studies have found and what you can see quite clearly from talking to people is they get a real rush after they take it. And that peak effect, that pleasurable effect, comes on within minutes, and then it starts to wane. And usually subjectively, it's not that they know they're still affected by the drug. It does last a few hours, but that high that they get comes off within the first couple, 2 or 3 hours, whereas the blood concentrations stay quite high and actually peak a bit later. When you're looking, half-life is 12 hours, so you're looking at a peak more around 3 or 4 hours, I believe. And then the thing is, when someone's coming off, so they start to come down, and they might, you know, the massive high that they get will start to come off, but they'll still feel quite wide awake, and they won't be able to sleep, and they won't feel hungry. And so they might not go to sleep that night. So they've got a choice. Either they take more to go out, party, or they will use something to come down and help them relax and sleep. I don't know what effect tolerance has on that. That's probably a bit of a side kick. But I also noticed that when people inject, it's different. They'll have a hit in the morning. And if they're very tolerant, they might have another hit at lunchtime. And I've met people who have 2 or 3 hits a day, which is a lot. But people who smoke, because they can put the pipe down and it recrystallizes and they have a bit more, they often have little hits. So they get that little peak of a high and then they'll wait an hour or so and then they'll have another one. And I'll say, how many hits have you had in a day? And I say, oh, 20 or 30. But they won't have a whole point in each hit. Point's about 0.1 to 0.2 of a gram. And that's a standard hit, if you like, if you were to inject. But they will titrate that point that they've got over a period of time to keep them nice and high throughout the day. So I think I went a bit off track there. Sorry.
No, that's good. So, Olaf, how do we interpret blood concentrations then when we get a case? We don't necessarily have contextual data on it.
A great difficulty. Effectively, you can't. I mean, you can talk about the parameters from one extreme to the other. Without the context, without knowledge of their tolerance, their prior usage, you're basically just tossing a coin. And that's the problem in driving situations where often there's no witnesses that come forward about driving behaviour. Just having a blood level, no matter how good the laboratory is in terms of quantifying a drug or drugs, saying that drug combination, unless it's up near the roof there, you just can't talk about a degree of impairment that might have created a crash situation there or a harm situation in another context. So the context is everything. Doesn't just apply to drugs, I suspect, but applies. So context, we need context, and that's often missing in cases, or context or the information is sporadic, is limited. And, you know, as best as I can when I do cases, I try and put the jigsaw together, but often there are pieces missing. And so you come up with various variations from one extreme to the other, which may not be helpful to the court.
But yeah, how do the courts, if the scientists have trouble interpreting it, how do the courts go, Olaf?
Well, look, usually understand the limitations of, you know, the tox evidence, if you like, tox results, but I dare say if it was more of a jury situation there, they would be confounded. They would not know where to go. They might believe, certainly there might be a myth in their own minds about, oh, I don't like methamphetamine, you know, if you use methamphetamine, it's got to be an adverse effect. There are others who don't believe that. It may even be users themselves, potentially. So, but you need, you know, effectively a majority, you know, everyone needs to say yes or no, or certainly yes in terms of getting a conviction. Drug facility, sexual assault cases are even more difficult because the context is only between two parties. One party may often is lying. So, look, it's not unusual, but, you know, context, investigation, medical records, witness statements, other statements that try to put together a picture is so important in virtually every case that I'm involved in.
So speaking of driving cases, how is the use of MDMA clinically going to impact on the landscape in terms of driving under the influence? Because MDMA is a prescribed drug in states in Australia. If you have MDMA in your system, like THC, like methamphetamine, you are guilty of an offence under the legislation.
Yeah, that applies to oral fluid detections and injured driver's detection where the limit is zero effectively for oral fluid or blood, depending on the measurement. Look, that scenario is coming out now with the cannabis scenario with using legalised cannabis in the sense to cannabis for various conditions. And at the moment, in most states, I think not all states, it's still illegal to have a positive THC in the oral fluid. There are moves to try to deal how to deal with that situation there. Yes, the doctor can say, yes, I've written this guy a prescription for this particular product, set of X, for example, but we know that some users will top up with illicit cannabis to get that high. They want highs. Set of X, you know, it has an effect, but it's not necessarily the same as what they've experienced given their previous illegal use of cannabis. So there's a temptation, and currently we cannot distinguish between illicit use and, you know, Sativex and other legal products in the future, because even illegal cannabis has CBD present, and that varies depending on the strain. So at the moment, we can't distinguish between the two from a tox point of view. There may be ways in the future we can do that, or we get away from using THC and CBD and use some other synthetic cannabinoid that is either it's prescribed for that purpose and may not have any illegal presence in the community, but even that may be impossible to control.
Just to add, I think the situation needs to be addressed for MDMA therapy, but I think it's an easier situation perhaps or a less vexed one than with medicinal cannabis for two reasons. One is MDMA is in your system for less time. So, yeah, you know, you might need to stay off the roads for a few more days than is sensible, but, you know, if that's what it takes, then maybe that's feasible. And in addition, it's not a product-based treatment. It's not something you're taking every day or every few days. You're probably only having it at most a few times a year, maybe once a year, maybe less, maybe three times in your whole life. That's the kind of standard protocol now, three times and that's it for you. So it definitely needs to be addressed. We do need to understand, you know, what the parameters are for somebody being unsafe after MDMA and how to, you know, educate the population about that and have some data to back that the functional impairment or the duration of the functional impairment. And then we also do need to deal with the situation that we're likely to have with people pulled over for convictions that are unjustified because they had their MDMA clinical session 2 days ago or a day ago. But I think it'll be less problematic than with medicinal cannabis, is my guess.
Yeah, there's a move to if they allow cannabis or in the future MDMA use and you have a prescription for that, providing you're not seen to be impaired when you be pulled over by the police or an oral fluid random stop. Because proving impairment can be quite difficult and residual amounts of cannabis or MDMA almost not cause impairment to the point they will be assessed to be impaired at the roadside. So I think that's reasonably okay from my perspective at least. And also the oral fluid testing, when it does occur, the device is not particularly sensitive for oral fluid. So there may be residual amounts in blood and oral fluid that may not be picked up 2 or 3 days after, you know, a controlled dose of ecstasy. Same applies to cannabis. As long as they're not topping up in recent time prior to their driving, they shouldn't be picked up. Having said that, there's only limited studies on that. Mm. There is a couple of studies that show that will be the case, but we need more of that to, I guess, encourage doctors to and users to actually feel they're secure enough to be able to drive at some point after they've had that dose of Sativex or other controlled administration cannabis or MDMA or other drugs in the future that might be used for psychedelic treatment or other forms of psychotherapy.
I think a broader issue is workplace testing. And this has come up for me. I've had people call me up and go, I'm in a lot of trouble because I've taken, and they might have also used illicit methamphetamine, but when they're on the mine side or whatever, they don't want to do that. So they take dexamphetamine. They might have been prescribed it. But they've got to declare it to their employer. And if they don't declare it to their employer, then they can lose their job. So whether people are going to be willing to go to their employer and go, oh, I'm doing MDMA-assisted therapy or I'm taking some type of cannabinoid will be a further challenge, I think.
Why do they need to declare it ahead of time? Why can't they show the proof that they're engaged in legal treatment?
Because it might impact on their performance on the job. And if you're working in a very large open-cut mine, you need to disclose all of any psychoactive substance that you're taking, whether it's antidepressants or an illicit. You're not meant to take the illicit ones, but, dexamphetamine or anything that might impact on your performance. So if you don't disclose that, then you're in breach of the contract that you have with them.
Yeah, I mean, it occurs to me that the employer shouldn't be the one determining your impairment, but your doctor.
Well, the doctor is obliged in Western Australia, for example, to put that on a medical register. So it's as soon as you get prescribed dexamphetamine that will go onto a register, which isn't the case in all states and territories. So it might be the doctor who decides it, but they still have to declare it.
Also a stigma, if you do declare that, the employer may well think adversely of your ability to do your job properly, even though you may well be, in fact, better than not having treatment. So that stigma will apply to that situation as well as other situations we're talking about this afternoon.
Yeah, these are complex issues and we could talk a lot more about them, I'm sure, but we're out of time today. One thing's for sure, amphetamines are in our community to stay, for better or worse, and trying to maximize the potential benefits of them while minimizing the harms is something that we all agree on and care about. And it's going to take a lot of collaboration between different experts across fields, across the political spectrum, in order to deal with these issues in the future. So please join me in thanking the panel.
Registration is now open for the 61st annual TAFT meeting, taking place from the 2nd to the 6th of September 2024 in St. Gallen, Switzerland. The early bird rate is only available until May 31st, so be sure to register soon for the reduced rate at www.taft2024.org. We look forward to welcoming you to St. Gallen for an inspiring, engaging, and enlightening conference.